Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 368, I chat with personal cinema architect John Bishop about the importance of aspect ratios. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 24th, 2017. Episode 368, all about aspect ratios. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is John Bishop, president of Bishop Architectural Entertainment Services. Hey, John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to be here.
And so happy to have you here. Those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Now, it always helps if you put my screen name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces, is anywhere in your message, in the comment that you put in the chat room, and that'll show up on a different color on my screen, and I'll be able to see it more easily. So, John, last time you were here, we were talking about your business as a personal cinema architect, and I'd like to delve a little more deeply into that this time. That was a few months ago, so those who don't remember that will cover a little bit of the same ground, but we're going to go a little deeper into a few topics here. And I think the place to start is where you normally start, which is to use cinema standards, commercial cinema standards, as a starting point for developing home theaters or home cinemas, right?
Right. Very true. Yeah, the term personal cinema architect was an outcropping of some work I did for Runco back in the day. So I go back to those, as you know, earliest days of home theater, CRT, transition to digital, transition to widescreen cinema, you know, the scope format used in homes for the first time. And I developed a program to help us design, you know, just the basics, you know, viewing geometry, light levels, picking projectors for a given screen size and making sure you're meeting the standards of cinema and the adaptation of cinema's performance to homes. And in that day, we were looking at film and trying to translate that using our video technology into something that was as close as possible to that real, genuine cinema experience. So there were a lot of people involved in those days looking at the same things. You were Joe Kane, Joel Silver, Sam Runco, Don Stewart, all of those folks were looking at the same thing. And that developed into something that I now call architectural cinema, because we went down a path which was really connected to the sort of technology and science of cinema, as opposed to the path that was more connected to consumer electronics and television. It was sort of that divergent fork in the road that led me to term what I was doing, being a personal cinema architect in the sort of non-literal sense of the word architect, but architecting cinemas for homes that were at a higher standard. Now I call that architectural cinema. And the reason is there's a term called architectural audio that came into practice back in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was coined by a company called ADS. And I was the executive vice president of that company, and Dr. Godehard Gunther was the owner and founder. Larry DeWitt was the VP of marketing. Joel Rosenblatt was the man in charge of custom installation before it had a name. And we developed these speakers that you could build into walls and put around homes for distributed music that was a much higher fidelity than the typical things going on during that time. And we called it architectural audio. We integrated it into the home's architecture.
Right. And in this case, it was in-wall, in-ceiling speakers, right?
Correct.
Which we still have today. And in fact, we're all going to be at CEDIA in a couple weeks, and we're going to see a lot of that.
Correct. And that term will be all over the place. Architectural audio has become kind of a generic term for, I think, something a little bit better. So today, I use the term architectural cinema to define what we're doing in residential spaces that is at a little bit higher level. It doesn't mean necessarily a higher price, but we just, they're not cheap, but we look at things in the same from the same viewpoint that professional cinema designers look at them. So we're not so interested in sequential contrast, which is kind of that ran down the road when plasmas were so bad and then things got better and it was like all about getting that contrast. In professional cinema, it's small area contrast. They're most interested in adjacent pixel contrast is the highest measure of sort of resolution and quality, and then small area contrast and ANSI contrast, you know, those 16 black and white squares is the next thing.
So, by the way, just to make sure everybody understands ANSI contrast, and you say black and white squares, what we're really talking about is a black and white checkerboard pattern on the screen, and you basically measure the brightness of the white squares and the darkness or the amount of light coming off the black squares, and you average each of those and you divide one by the other and you get ANSI contrast ratio, which is very different from measuring an entire white screen or in your, as you say, a smaller area, a window of white, and then a black screen and making that calculation. Those result in very different numbers.
Oh, dramatically. I mean, you got numbers, they're literally dividing by zero, so it's infinite. I mean, they have zero black level, so what is the real contrast? None of that has much to do with the art of movies and how they're created and intended to be seen in a professional cinema exhibition. You know, that the ANSI contrast numbers that you get in real cinemas are on the order of 2 and 300 to 1.
Right.
Not 2 and 3,000, not 2 and 3 million. But 2 to 300 to 1, and the there may
and
be a little bit
and
better
that's
now.
Under really good, and that's like the best you can get, right?
Yeah, throw something over the exit sign, or it will completely blow the measurement. You know that kind of stuff. And you know, we will talk about Dunkirk. You and I both saw Dunkirk in Southern California, and you saw it before me, and gave me a heads up. Pardon me, I touched the table that the camera is on. Warn me when I start shaking. It's not me.
It's
doing something to it.
All right, that's fine.
You saw Dunkirk, and you gave me some interesting information about the sound levels. So I was very interested in what was going on. And I saw it also in 70 millimeter at the Del Mar Cinema. It's a, I believe it's a, that's a Cinemark. Not sure now. I don't remember. It was phenomenal. That was 8 perf 70 millimeter in scope. Not in flat and not with the bouncing scope to flat scenes that a lot of the presentations do, including the IMAX 70 millimeter. And I saw that out here.
Right.
And probably the best contrast that I saw, I mean, it was a battle between the conventional 70 millimeter, which was very good in a very good room, and the 6P laser IMAX on a 60 by 80 foot screen, which to me was far and away the best presentation. The best image quality, best immersion, very good sound in that theater. It's a 12. It's the 12-channel new immersive audio IMAX system.
Except that the audio for Dunkirk wasn't mixed in that 12-channel. It was only mixed in 6.
And I don't know how they used that, but you know the IMAX surround layer is up at the ceiling anyway. So I'm not exactly sure how they're integrating. They've got some side speakers now and some virtually on the 4 speakers on the ceiling, and we've got some pictures. I took some pictures in the theater to compare. But first of all, the brightness level is a factor. You know, they always tweak those TVs up in the showrooms. The brightest one always wins. We're not comparing things, but the IMAX brightness with their twin 6P laser projectors is well over 30 foot Lamberts. I think it's brighter than Dolby Vision, because I think they always want to be the toughest guy in town.
Well, now this is a point of contention, I think, because I'll have to look into this, because last I heard from IMAX, their peak brightness in their twin laser projector setup was 22 foot Lamberts, as opposed to Dolby Vision, which is 31.
Very interesting. Now, 22 was their standard for all of their dual D DCI 2K setups. And I went to a theater in Manchester, Connecticut, literally just to sort of survey it for a dealer friend of mine to tell him it was a good one to go see Dunkirk in or not. And I walked into the theater. I spoke to the manager on duty and asked him if I could go in, and I asked him a few questions about the theater. What was the technology? What was the screen size? And how were you presenting Dunkirk? And this was an IMAX room. It was a Cineplex IMAX. So this was a 50-foot screen, basically, flat screen with dual 2K projectors, not immersive audio. And I went in there, and it looked very good. That was one of the better presentations. And I came back and asked him about the light levels, and he said, well, they were just here. Let me look it up. And he pulled up the data on the last calibration, and it was 11-foot Lamberts per projector. So that's 22-foot Lamberts.
Foot Lamberts do add linearly.
Oh, sure. Two projectors add, double.
So it gives you 22-foot Lamberts, which is what they have told me on several occasions that's what their laser standard is. Yeah.
I would be surprised if the laser standard was that low. You know, they just went from 30,000 lumen to 70,000 lumen machines. And to not use that, and it looks brighter. It looks a little bit brighter, but I don't know. I haven't seen. They like to keep their cards pretty close to the vest.
They do. You're right about that. You're exactly right about that. Yeah. Well, while we're talking about Dunkirk, I mean, we might as well talk about Dunkirk. We have you sent me a PDF of the various venues that you visited with that. So let's take a look at that.
Let's bring it up. So these are opening. Yeah, in this is the 6P Laser Theater again, and the heading shows that. So the opening, it's interesting. The opening graphic, those aspect ratios are true. That's as wide as Ultra Panavision. You know, the Hateful Eight is 2.76:1 that Quentin Tarantino shot a couple of years ago, and that's the opening graphic for IMAX on there. This is a 60-foot high, 80-foot wide screen. And they chose to do that. That's just their presentation. Below are two scenes from Dunkirk. All of the scenes on the little boat tend to be in scope. So there it is, and you can see that's
before
the
Before we go on, I want you to define scope and flat. You used those terms earlier, and I want to make sure everybody knows what they mean.
Sure. So scope coming from CinemaScope and the original widescreen variants that were all started by Cinerama, but that used three projectors and was very wide and was cumbersome, and only a dozen or so theaters were ever built in this country. But Todd Ayo had another idea, and you and I saw that. That'll come up later in this graphic at a SMPTE meeting at the Dunn Academy Theater. And so scope is the shorthand term for what was CinemaScope. That's no longer a trademark. You know, no, there's no CinemaScope production, but there's scope via Panavision and those processes. And that's just a wide aspect ratio where the width is about 2.4 times the height. So that's the shape of the movie.
That's the shape of the image, the shape of the screen. May or may not be that, but very often, people with home theaters install projection screens that are 2.4:1 aspect ratio. That is 2.4 times wider than they are tall, because that's what a lot of movies, that's the aspect ratio of a lot of movies. That's as opposed to HD or television broadcast, which is 16:9 or 1.78:1. So that's not as wide an aspect ratio. What is flat?
Flat is the Hollywood, the cinema term for the 1.85:1 format, which is the Academy flat ratio, is just their term.
So that's just another aspect ratio is all it is.
Yes. And it's interesting. I was at one of my dealers, Take 5 Audio, on Saturday, and one of their customers is a retired producer. And we were looking at this new Barco Loki 4K projector, and it's his, and I was doing some setup on it. And he came down to visit his product before it comes into his theater. And what's new that he didn't experience before, he's got a traditional Cinewide setup, the original Runco setup with an anamorphic lens and a 2.4 to 1 screen. And that allowed you to have 2.4 to 1. You hit a button and now you're watching your content in 1.78, you know, 16 by 9 or smaller, you know, the 1.33 to 1 classic era cinema comes out automatically in the 1.78 window. It's the way they are on the Blu-ray. But this is an electronic aspect ratio controlled machine. It's actually a 2160 by 5120 pixel machine. So it's pixel, the image container that they use to project onto the screen is a 2.4 to 1 aspect ratio at 2160p, the 4K pixel resolution vertically.
So in other words, just to make sure everyone's on the same page, 2160 pixels top to bottom, and in this case, 5120, is that right?
Yes, 2.4 times 2160 comes out to right about that.
Yep, exactly right. Yeah. So that's a projector that actually has a native 2.4 to 1 aspect ratio. Most home theater projectors have an aspect ratio, a native aspect ratio of 16 by 9 or 1.78 to 1. And you can make wider pictures in a couple of different ways. One is simply not use all the top pixels top and bottom. Another way is to use what these anamorphic lenses, as you call them, which actually optically stretch things. But you also need some electronic processing to accommodate these lenses. Are you saying that the Barco Loki, which is a very high-end projector, doesn't use anamorphic lenses? It uses all electronics to get the aspect ratio
correct.
It needs?
That's okay. Correct. And there are trade-offs there. The anamorphic approach, especially when you use cinema-grade lenses, like one behind me on a projector is a $15,000 lens, and that's the secondary lens. So you don't really have any compromises there. But it gets the entire, as they call it, image container on the screen. That 16 by 9 chip that's in the projector is having its shape changed by the optics to put a 2.4 image on the screen, and every pixel is there. In the case of this projector, it's 1080 by 1920, reshaped to be a 2.4 to 1 aspect ratio. Well, the projector I showed him, I said, you can now electronically go to every aspect ratio that the film content is available in. So in the past, if you put a movie on that was flat, 1.85 to 1, as probably 40% of all movies are, in modern production, you'll have either a little black bar at the top and bottom of your screen when you look at it in the 1.78 window, or if you go to the 2.40, you're just cutting a bunch of the movie off, but you're filling your screen. Not a great compromise. With the electronic aspect ratio control in this projector, you hit a button. It's called 1.85, and it simply moves the image to fill the top and bottom while expanding the width because the pixels are already there. It just rescales the image to fit every vertical pixel and the horizontal pixels that are defined by the aspect ratio of the content. And there are stops for 2.20 to 1, all the 70 millimeter content that was done in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s is available on Blu-ray. And that's, you know, The Sound of Music and things like that are 2.2 to 1. Mm-hmm. And it's even got 2.35 and 2.40. And there are movies that are on Blu-rays that were shot a slightly different way. In the earlier CinemaScope, it was 2.35 to 1. And later on, they kind of settled on the 2.40 to 1, having to do with cinema exhibition more than anything else. But that's what they gave us on the Blu-ray. So if you have a 2.40 screen and you fill the width with 2.35 content, you've got a little bit of your image up into the borders of the screen. Well, this system allows you to simply have every pixel on the screen, and it will leave the border on the sides where they belong if your screen's 2.4 to 1. So all of that just means electronically an instant change in aspect ratio puts the movie up in the shape the director intended and in the height of the screen. And good cinema design starts with the viewing geometry, if I can go back to our first principle. And that's defined by where you're sitting relative to the height of the screen. If you're between 1.5 and 3 screen heights from your screen via the seating you have in your theater, you're in the prime seating that most people agree are best in professional theaters.
Now, let me ask you this about that, seating distance. based upon screen height or screen width, because most of the time I hear the same formula you just gave, 2.5 to 3 times the screen height for HD. And then we can talk about 4K or UHD, which is the ITU specifies, that's the International Telecommunications Union, specifies 1.5 times the screen height, but that's really close. Plus, you have to deal with the field of view. That is, you know, how much of your field of view does the screen take up? And if it's 2.40:1, very wide aspect ratio, and you're sitting 1.5 times the screen height, you're going to have to move your head right and left to see the whole picture, right?
Yes, and that's just what the directors want you to do. So I'll say that the T in ITU stands for television.
I think it's telecommunication, but
okay, well, close enough. I'm going to stick with television to make my point.
All right,
and the
all
point
right,
is,
right.
In cinema, traditionally, screen height has defined your seating layout since the earliest days of film cinema at 1.33:1 aspect ratio. And you're sitting in a 1.5 to 3 times the height position from that screen. And it really doesn't change with 4K or 2K. Because
really?
Until you get so close to the pixel structure that you see the pixel structure, then it's all a clean mosaic that disappears and you're simply seeing the image. So if the characteristics of the image are the same, the inner pixel contrast, the small area contrast, and the ANSI contrast, if they're the same, professionals in the industry can't tell the difference at 1.5 screen heights between 2K and 4K. And you've had people on Home Theater Geeks. I could go back and find the episode, but it was in the 200s where they were doing the tests at the Academy, one of the theaters in Hollywood. I'm not sure it was the Samuel Goldwyn. But
right.
the guests that you had were sitting in the front row, and they had a 2K and a 4K projector and the content for that in the booth. And they told the guy to switch between 4K and 2K. And literally he said on your show, put the 2K back on. And of course they were looking at 2K. They really couldn't see difference. And that was
front row.
Yeah. And there's a reason. And actually Christy has a white paper on that, and all the cinema, certainly the DLP cinema camp talks about it because they have 2K and 4K projectors. And that is your visual resolution. And we talked about this just a little bit in the last episode I was on. But the resolution of human vision is based on looking at, you know, the Snellen chart, black text on a white background or vice versa, but black text on a white background lit under 40 or 50 foot Lamberts of light. And it's still, and it's letters of the alphabet. You can pick up a certain resolution and say, that's my visual acuity. But in cinema, you have moving images in a darker environment, and you can't see the pixel structure at 1.5 screen heights from a 1080p DCI projector. Just can't see it.
Even at 1.5 times the screen height.
Even 1.5 times. You have to get closer than that before you start to see the pixel structure. Mm. And you'll only see it under certain conditions, like a really bright, fully lit, even all white screen or blue sky, you might tend to see a pixel structure when you're a little closer than 1.5 screen heights on a 2K projector. But other than that, and the point here is you don't have to worry about 4K and 2K. And in our world, 1080p or 2160p, we weren't designing theaters where the front row was 3 screen heights back in the 1080p days. We barely did that in the 720p days. And SMPTE did that study where they looked at the resolution of 35 millimeter film and found its native resolution was basically equivalent to 720p. So film theaters are a piece of history when it comes to viewing geometry. So you walk into any theater that was designed based on film, and they got away with that with 720p resolution. So that's why we don't really need to obsess over that too much.
Got
in
it.
terms terms of screen sizing. So I do screen sizing by height, and I like to let the width define it from there. And you mentioned turning your head. You know, the Cinerama, Fred Waller spec was 140 degrees was the maximum viewing geometry, the horizontal viewing geometry that he wanted you to see. And he certainly wanted you to turn your head. Directors, Alfred Hitchcock was famous for wanting you to turn your head because he had something coming up from the other side of the screen that was going to, you know, scare the heck out of you. That was the idea for turning your head. And if you look at this, let's go back to the graphic and move maybe to the next page. But this IMAX theater is a 60-foot high screen, and the back of the room, the back wall, is 90 feet away. So that screen height is 1.5 screen height.
The back wall is one and a half screen heights.
For the last row, that's correct. Now, that theater was designed in the 70-millimeter days. And it converted to 2K, twin projector 2K, and it is now 6P laser 4K. And people tend to sit in the middle to the back, and that's because of the imposing vertical viewing geometry.
Sure.
Josh, let's move up a couple of pages and one more. And just that's the sound system. So there's some shots of the, you know, it started out life as a 5.1. The lower left corner shows their, the 5.1 based main speakers. And the picture right above that shows two little boxes on the ceiling. There's actually four. There's two behind that going towards the back of the theater.
Those are the overhead speakers. Yeah.
The overheads. In fact, the image on the right shows the back overheads and one of the rear left corner as you're facing the screen and the projection booth. So that's kind of what they're doing today. And you can sort of see the surround speakers that are down the sidewall there as well. They've added a few of those. Let's go to the next page and just see. Let's see what we get. So this shot is the 70-millimeter projector from this is an 8-perf presentation that was done at the Del Amo Theater in Torrance. There's the Century 70-millimeter projector that I'm sure they brought in for that. I don't think they sit on those projectors.
No, I think you're right. And before you go on, let me just make sure everybody understands again that when you refer to 8-perf, that refers to the little perforations along the side of the film. And for this 70-millimeter film, there are 8 perforations per frame. In the case of IMAX 70-millimeter, I believe it's 15, right?
Correct. And that's because in conventional projectors, you've got reels above and below, a supply and a take-up reel.
Right. The film is traveling vertically. Vertically. It's coming from the top and going to the bottom. Whereas in IMAX 70-millimeter, the film is traversing sideways.
And that gives them more film surface area, and that takes up 15 perfs worth. So every frame is larger, and it's 15 perfs worth of the film. And that's why it's the highest resolution film format that we've ever had. And that's why Christopher Nolan went to it, starting, I think, with the Batman Dark Knight Rises or something like
one,
that.
Yeah, Dark Knight Rises, I think, was shot about half of it with IMAX 70-millimeter film.
Yeah, and he did the same thing. The IMAX was in presentation, it was usually 1.85:1 because that's what most IMAX theaters are now. But in theaters that were original 70-millimeter theaters, like there's one in West Nyack, New York, that a friend of mine and I went out to see Interstellar at that theater because it was it was the closest place we could see that in 70-millimeter. Mm-hmm. And it's a treat to be able to see a modern production using state-of-the-art everything today on film from an artist like Christopher Nolan and Quentin Tarantino, who did it again for The Hateful Eight. And now we can take a look at, what was that reference film image quality that we used to experience all the time, but we couldn't find it to save our lives today? And we're seeing it. And I'll say that the 270-millimeter presentations I saw, one was pretty stunning and maybe even unique relative to digital, but not drastically so. That 6P laser was absolutely amazing and I think superior. The other one, the 15 perf, was a little disappointing, and that was the theater and the setup. They had issues with the the coupling of the film to the aperture going through the lens. You could just see a little wiggle there. There was stuff going on that was sort of a side effect of the film.
Right. I have to tell you,
theater. It was an aquarium museum theater.
Oh, wow. Okay. So they should have had their act together.
Yeah. So it was good, but not great. And I think I ranked it among the five that I ranked like number four. So Josh, we go down to the next images. We're now looking at the shots from that 6P laser theater. One more. I'll keep saying one more until I see what I'm looking for. You're going the wrong direction. Okay. So there's the first one. Now the next one should be it. Yeah, that's it. So those are images that I took that are sort of classic scenes from the movie, that the airplane landing with when he's out of gas. Those shots are IMAX shot content that is absolutely amazing. When he's looking through the binoculars, the admiral's looking, you know, he sees the Armada showing up and gets all excited. That's a scope shot in the same screen, but with, you know, one third of it only being used because there's a black bar on the top and bottom. And below that, we should say this about Dunkirk,
as I think you mentioned, he actually intended, Christopher Nolan intended, for the aspect ratio to change, that when you were on the beach and in many of these shots, it was the full IMAX ratio of actually 1.9:1, close to flat, 1.85:1, but it was actually 1.9:1, according to my research. And that's very much taller than you're used to seeing in a cinema. But then certain shots were in that 2.2 or 2.3:1 aspect ratio with black bars on the top and bottom. And if you saw it in an IMAX 70 millimeter film projection or the IMAX 6P laser, then you saw that change happen. But in most other theaters, you didn't. It got cropped.
On the aspect ratios is true for the IMAX Cineplex theaters, the ones that converted existing rooms in, you know, the 300 seat theaters with a 32x55-foot screen. And those are 1.89:1. Screens using a technology to project onto it. But in the 6P laser theater that we're looking at, that's a 70 millimeter original theater, and that's 1.43:1. That is 60 feet high, that image. And if you look at the smallest image on the page, that's to the right of the page, you see I'm looking down the seats in front of me at the bottom of the screen, and you see heads in the image because that is 60 feet top to bottom. That is from the floor to the ceiling of that room. And it's 80
feet wide. Six stories tall.
And 80 feet wide. So it's an impressive theater. And they obviously formatted the projectors. You know, they did something, cropping or just doing the DCP for this theater, for these type of theaters, to exhibit this in 1.43:1. And then the scope is 2.4:1, as it always is. So that's
right.
That's
a pretty big image. I made a mistake. I said the image moved between 1.9:1 and 2.4:1. It didn't. It moved from 1.43:1.
Yeah.
To 2.2 to 1.
Yeah.
And you saw it in that way, right? You saw at least one presentation where it did do that. Shifting of aspect ratio. I did too in the IMAX, an actual IMAX 70 millimeter film. And I did not notice particularly but it wasn't jarring or distracting for that aspect ratio to change, which I always find very interesting.
Yeah. There was one movie, which was the Star Wars movie, the big one that came out before this last one, where the, there was one scene that was – the entire movie was presented in scope, but there was one scene where the top and bottom filled in.
I didn't notice.
And it was a two-minute scene, and it was when you first saw the Star Wars ship.
The bad guy's ship.
Yeah, exactly. For 2 minutes, they filled the screen. The rest of the entire movie was scope. So for some emphasis, they did that because they could, I guess. So,
before we continue, Beatmaster in the chat room is reminding us that it was the Dark Knight, not the Dark Knight Rises.
Gotcha.
Nolan used. And before we get any further, Emily the Strange had a couple questions I wanted to make sure to get in here, which is, how can someone at home with a quote unquote normal projector, is it even possible to see these changing aspect ratios?
That is a great question, because when we're designing a theater, we have choices to make. And one of the first choices is the viewing geometry, I said, is the first principle. And mm-hmm. how do you know what that's going to be? You have to choose your format. And your format used to be either scope or 1.78. In our world, it was usually 1.78. And a lot of people chose 1.78 because I got a bigger picture for my sports viewing. And that's a mistake. That really indicates a mistake was made, because the height should be determined by your seating layout and the space that you have, in that 1.5 to 3 screen height range. Uh-huh. And the width should then just be allowed to go to whatever aspect ratio you want to limit yourself at, 2.4:1. If you do it that way, then you don't have a smaller image. You just have a different shaped image for sports watching. But right. Today we do have a third option to consider, and that I call large format. And that picture showing my view down the seats to the bottom of that screen, that truly is large format. And I have a dealer, the one I showed in our last time together from Realm in Connecticut, where they built a theater that has a 10-foot high by 18-foot wide director's choice screen. And the first row is 8 feet back. Basically they've got 8, 14, and 20 feet. 8 feet back from a 10-foot high screen, it's 10 feet back from a 10-foot high screen is pretty much in your face.
Right.
But they can hit a button
1:1
and convert that to a scope format screen, which is 7.5 feet by 18. At 7.5 feet, you're about 1.5 screen heights to that 10-foot row, that first row.
Yep.
That's perfectly acceptable. And he can format all of his movies at that height if he wants to, including 1.85 movies. But if he wants to hit that button and have that 10-foot by 18-foot image for the Super Bowl or for any Mad Max, whatever you think is going to be you want to pin yourself to the back of the seat, then you have that option. And I call that large format. And it's best when you're able to mask it properly, because then you don't have to have throwaway seats like the first row in most commercial cinemas.
Right, right. That's what I was going to say. What you need, first of all, is a screen. You don't need masking. Masking being panels of black material that can be moved in and out to change the aspect ratio of the actual active screen area. That's the ideal situation, but it's pretty expensive to do, especially when you've got motorized four-way masking, that is both horizontal and vertical.
Yes.
You don't need that, but if you just leave black images, black areas on the screen to accommodate different aspect ratios, that's going to affect your contrast, your perceived contrast, right?
Yeah, perception. And perception is reality. It will not look as good. And because of that, I'm not a big fan of the edgeless screens, which really mimic TVs. But we're doing that in front projection as well. And I sell them. I offer them. But that black border tells your eye what's going on. It's where the image stopped, and it your perception of the contrast is superior, and it's just framed properly. It's like an unframed picture versus a beautifully matted and framed portrait. It just looks better. And if you can do that for every aspect ratio, And again, I'll go back to last time we were together. I showed you a job that I did with Goodwin's High End, and this was a real art enthusiast, art of movies and art of sculpture and fine art and everything else in his home. And we had a side masking vistascope with 11 aspect ratios that were programmed to be perfectly masked from 1.2 to 1, you know, city lights and sort of the early Chaplin movies and that early era of cinema to 1.33 to 1.66 to 1.78 to 1.85 to 2.0 we did. And we talked about Univisium by Vittorio Storaro, who created this 2.0 to 1 aspect ratio. And then the 2.2, in his case, 2.35, 2.40, and 2.55 to 1. We did a screen like the one behind me. In fact, if I step out of the way, my white screen there that you can see well enough, I'm sure, in the background is 2.55 to 1 aspect ratio.
Wow. And are there any movies that are 2.55 to 1?
Oh, dozens upon dozens. The entire first decade of CinemaScope was shot in 2.55 to 1. Well, Scott, you and I just experienced a couple of 2.55 to 1 movies properly masked at the Linwood Dunn Theater, the Academy Theater in Hollywood.
That
was The King and I and Oklahoma. All the Marilyn Monroe movies that were in scope in that era, Rebel Without a Cause, the entire first decade of CinemaScope was 2.55 to 1. And we have those on Blu-ray, and I'm not sure what we have on Ultra HD in 2.55 to 1, maybe nothing at this point, but perhaps someday we'll have that. But again, I talked about 2K versus 4K. It's almost immaterial. You've got content that is at that native aspect ratio. So we had the space to do it for this gentleman, and we have 11 aspect ratios. He's truly seeing the art the way it was intended to be seen. And Josh, let's move down the document that we're looking at, because we will get to that Linwood Dunn Theater presentation and see those images. But first, we'll get to the next Dunkirk presentation. So this is a single 2K DCI projector in a nice Cinemark theater in Reno at the Riverwalk. That was a very good presentation, and it did do the 2.40 to 1.85 bounce.
Really? I didn't think any standard digital cinema presentations did that. I thought they all were cropped and had one aspect ratio.
Nope. They're getting files that do it, and this theater did it. The only one that was native scope only that I saw was actually the 70 millimeter in Torrance. That was masked,
which
in
was
scope
conventional, and presented in conventional scope. 70 millimeter, not IMAX 70 millimeter.
8x7. I'm sure that's why they decided they're not going to put a skinny picture on the 8x. They're just going to have the whole thing be scope.
Right. So,
all right, let's move down to the next images and see what we've got. Okay, here's the Linwood Dunn Theater the Todd AO. This is just the presentation, so go on to the next. You know, what's important here is this is a theater built by the people who create the art that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And Scott, you're down there on the floor. I don't know if you can see yourself, but I'm reaching
pointing
out
at
to
the
someone.
Guy, I think. Yeah, yes, I am. Indeed,
yeah. So move on to the next page. Right, and this was the top image is that that industry film that 20th Century Fox put out to promote CinemaScope, and they had
an MGM.
Full orchestra, and maybe it was Fox had to be involved because CinemaScope was Fox, but but anyway, it was an industry film. That's 2.55 to 1, and it was a film that picked up on a lot of the cues from the This Is Cinerama film, you know, the roller coaster and all that, if you might recall.
Right.
And that is masked and presented on film. This is 70 millimeter film in 2.55 to 1. And they told us that this won the Oscar for the documentary that year.
Yeah. 1950-something, I think.
And there's the theater. I mean, that's a shot of the gentleman who was a virtuoso on an instrument he called the movie player, the silent era sound effects, piano, music, organ, and all of that stuff that was played while people were watching silent era
films. That was amazing. This is basically a player piano with two player roles so he could switch between them. And not only did it have a piano, it had a pipe organ, it had a xylophone, it had drums, it had all kinds of different sound effects that he could play in real time while watching. Basically, many silent movie theaters had this instrument in them, and somebody would come in and accompany the silent movie with music playing on
you
the player.
You would hear footsteps. If there was somebody on the screen running down the street, you'd hear their footsteps. This guy would make the sound of
this
the footsteps.
Guy was,
horses,
he was
hooves,
doing the Foley
all of these sound
in real
effects
time.
From this machine. Yeah, it was it was unbelievable. But this shot that we're looking at is a very good shot of the viewing geometry of a theater created by the people who make the art. I'm in the very last row. Certainly no more than three screen heights away. There is actually a site plan on their website where you can look at the viewing geometry. You know, the size of the screen is in the specs page. You can see the layout of the rows. And this is about three screen heights back. And we were looking in this case at a 185 image of that guy playing a piano that was in the lobby with the cameras and the lighting set
with
up.
With the cameras
to see
on him. Yeah, exactly.
We heard state-of-the-art silent era movie player sound. Best it's ever been presented, I'm sure.
By the way, Mike Heiss is in the chat room. I don't know if you know Mike or not. He's a frequent guest on the show. He said he agrees. He thinks it was MGM, but it was in scope. And I'm pretty sure I remembered that orchestra that we saw that was actually the film was basically a music video of them playing. Was the MGM orchestra.
Yeah, I'll go back and look at that. I did some video of the presenter, and I might have that on the video. But that's interesting because CinemaScope is a 20th Century Fox patented, the only people that could do it for the first number of years before Panavision came in, and they sort of had their heyday, you know, and they went out. But the MGM connection, how that happened, I don't know, but it'll be interesting to look at.
Yeah. Before we go on, there was a question back here I wanted to get to, which was again from Emily the Strange, which is here it is. We're talking about manipulating the picture to produce different aspect ratios, be it anamorphic lens to stretch things out or different aspect ratios. She asks a very good question, which is, does manipulating the image like this in one way or another, electronically or optically, cause a loss in picture quality?
Emily, your questions are not strange. They're very good. I don't know where you got your name, but it's not from your quality of questions.
It's her screen name and proud of it, I'm sure.
Indeed. The answer is no, it should not, because we're using, if there's a fundamental, you know, a precept in my architectural cinema concept, it is we're using the science of cinema. So if it's the thing they did to present it originally, it is the quality that they originally intended. So there are ways to do it. The anamorphic method was the way they did scope projection in all of the film era and certainly the first half decade of the digital era. They got past that because they found the digital projectors were good enough to zoom up, which is another testimony to the fact that the 2K projectors were fine because they'd even zoom them up to fit a scope screen and then mask it back down. And that's a digital zoom. Well, no, it's an optical zoom. They're just putting the black bar pixels.
Oh, above okay. Yeah. I got it.
And we still didn't have a problem with that. I've never heard anybody walked out of a digital theater saying I had a problem with the image. Mm-hmm. They're so superior to what was, you know, film theaters would vary a lot. That's where THX got into their theater alignment program. The TAP program in 1977 was, you know, George Lucas's disgust with the quality of cinemas in the day. They just weren't taking care of their screens and their lamps and, you know, the sound chain and all of that stuff. But but the answer to the question, Emily, is we're using the same approach. So if we're doing a zoomed up image and it's 800 by 1920 or 1600 by 3840, That's basically what they're doing in commercial cinema. If the projector is capable of that, you do it. Like the Sony projectors, the 4K projectors, that's the mechanism they usually use. And it's also known as lens memory or indexed lens memory or whatever term. But it's literally zooming up to get the black bars off of the screen and fill the scope-shaped screen, and then zooming back down to fill the 16:9 window. The challenge
when you have a 2.4 image, you zoom in, and when you have a 16:9 image like sports or TV, you zoom back out, and you're still getting the same the correct aspect ratio.
Yes. And that's challenge is to get it perfect every time, that the focus hasn't shifted, the position hasn't shifted, the size hasn't shifted. And to do that 5 times in a row, you know, you may have to tweak it yourself, and that's not something that we want our customers doing typically. The anamorphic method, Runco called it dual mode, because the lens moves out of the way and the 16:9 image just falls onto the screen perfectly where you left it. So it's 1080x1920, and it's a 16:9 window on your 240 screen. The lens, anamorphic lens, is then motorized to shift back into the path, and it spreads the image horizontally. That's a fixed optical system. It never changes. So that was very reliable and dependable. Now, right, the electronic system, which you can do using processing, like Lumigen has it built into some of their processors. Runco had it built into their processors. I call it electronic CineWide. It's fast. It's convenient. It's geometrically perfect and never changes. So that's a real benefit.
I'm just going to play devil's advocate here for a second. The electronic shifting of aspect ratio, as you're talking about, sometimes involves scaling, does it not?
Always. Yes, it does. And that has to be well done, that's a compromise.
Scaling is always going to compromise the image quality to some degree, isn't it?
Yes.
Because scaling, I make sure everybody understands what that is, scaling is when you take a certain picture, which has a certain number of pixels horizontally and vertically, and you change that number of pixels horizontally and or vertically, which means you're going to have to create some new pixels, some synthetic pixels, or you're going to have to remove some pixels, and you're going to have to do some things. And generally what that ends up doing is reducing the effective resolution on the screen. So how do you deal with that?
Two things are of concern when you're scaling: introduction of artifacts and loss of interpixel contrast. That adjacent pixel contrast, I said, is the most important thing. So you want to look at what's happening and know that your quality of scaling is appropriate. The theater I described that we did with Goodwin's High End that had 11 aspect ratios, zero scaling. It was a memory system with a lens and screen that had 11 memory slots that we could perfectly move the pixels onto the screen. So every pixel was there vertically, and the horizontal aspect ratio was defined by the content, and there was no loss. Now, there is a trade-off, because my 2.55:1 image is now – this was a 2K DCI projector. So the projector was $140,000. This was, you know, the optics and everything about it was as good as it gets. And the servo-controlled phase-lock-looped memory of the lens was perfect. It didn't shift over time. All of those things were addressed by throwing a lot of money and sophistication at it.
You have that same functionality in many home theater projectors. The one you're talking about is, I guess you could call it a home theater projector. It's a stretch. It's a really expensive home. Yeah. But much less expensive projectors have that same capability of storing the lens, focus, zoom settings to do what you're talking about. But as you said a moment ago, if you do it 5 times between one and another, you might start drifting away from
so
the perfect
setting.
That'll
be a challenge. If your focus is a little off, you've lost resolution. Focus, basically, the first thing you see when things are slightly defocused is a loss of interpixel contrast. If a checkerboard pattern is put up and each square is a single pixel, black and white, that's the highest resolution image you can generate from the projector. It's sort of the highest frequency response of that projector is being shown.
Right.
If the pixels stay black and the white ones are bright white, you have a very good projector, signal path, and processing under control. But as soon as you introduce processing, the blackness of those black pixels turned grayer, and the whiteness of those white pixels dim down a little bit. Interpixel contrast is compromised. So that's one of the issues you have to look at. You want something that does a very good job. The other issue that you can't get around is you are putting pixels outside the screen area. So a 1080 by 1920 image is all the pixels in the image container, the chip, are on the screen. It's as much contrast as you can get. When you go to scope, it's now 800 by 1920. Right. And if you go to 255 to one scope, it's now 650 by 1920. So you're giving – that's the trade-off in what some call the perfect approach. The anamorphic lens system had minor processing to fill in that vertical black bar area. And if it was well done, you didn't lose much pixel contrast. And then the quality of the optics was everything. And we sold very poor quality optics in our consumer market and extremely precise cinema grade optics in our consumer market. So it depended on that and setup. It takes quite a lot of know-how to get the settings all correct as well. But Emily, that was a good question. The trade-offs are the same ones that cinema decides to make. When they went from anamorphic to lens memory, they traded off that issue for another. Quite frankly, it was they didn't have to have people sophisticated enough to mess with these lenses. They could sort of take control of it electronically. So maybe we want to go back to the document as well while you're getting that next question, Scott.
Okay, the next question is from Beatmaster. And he's asking, what about the director's vision versus the practicality of it being presented in its format? Tarantino tried for The Hateful Eight, but look how it turned out. I'm not sure I know what you mean there, Beatmaster. Give us a little bit more information here, because The Hateful Eight was also shot on 70 millimeter film and presented on 70 millimeter film, not IMAX 70 millimeter. I think it was conventional 70 millimeter. I don't think it changed aspects.
No, it wasn't. And so I don't care what Beatmaster meant. I will fill in the blanks for him. It came out
okay,
spectacularly. And here's why. It was anamorphic 70 millimeter using ultra Panavision lenses that hadn't been used in decades. The last time they were used, I think it was the Tom Cruise movie in the 80s, Going Out West movie. I forget the name of it. But anyway, it was Ultra Panavision, which is 2.76:1 aspect ratio, using the entire frame of the 70 millimeter film, stretching it with an anamorphic lens in theater presentation, and capturing it with an anamorphic lens that squeezed it when shooting with the film cameras. So he did something very unique. Now, if what did you call a Beatmaster saw a poor presentation of it, that's perfectly possible. I saw an awesome presentation of it at the Somerville Theater just outside of Boston. And now I'm going to try something. Can you see the dying of the light?
Indeed.
And that is a documentary. I found this at Amoeba, Scott, which is a place know well.
Okay. That's a record store in Hollywood.
The projectionist at the Somerville Theater required the theater, when they hired him, to buy two new 70 millimeter, 35 millimeter projectors, the best ever made, by his own definition. That's a picture of one of them on the cover.
Okay. This is a DVD, basically.
This is a DVD. It's called The Dying of the Light. And he spends a lot of time talking about cinema and the transition from film. I think he's thinking digital is allowing the lights to die on film. But nonetheless, in his theater, he presented it with these twin 70 millimeter projectors with anamorphic lenses in an 800-seat room. This was an originally a vaudeville era theater from the 20s. So it's got all of that decor and beauty and state of the art digital projection and these two 70 millimeter film projectors. And the people that built the anamorphic lenses for that presentation were in the theater at the showing that I happened to attend. And we had a little chat afterward with the projectionist. And that presentation was phenomenal. And where do you get a chance to see? Now, Ultra Panavision is 2.76:1. There aren't a lot of those on Blu-ray, but there are maybe a dozen or so. So I seek them out. I've got a number of them, and they're phenomenal. And when Cinerama went to the 70 millimeter version, you know, Todd Ayo was trying to do a single camera and projector version of Cinerama, you might say, with Todd Ayo. They were shooting some on 70 millimeter and sometimes anamorphic lenses. So you'll see it's a it's a mad world. And that is a light movie because that is 2.76:1 shot in Ultra Panavision. And shot in my old stomping ground up in the Joshua Tree and Yucca Valley area.
Oh, you came from there. Wow.
Indeed.
That's kind of cool.
Josh, let's go back to our document and see what we find if we page down a little bit.
Oh, we're looking here. We're looking here again at the SMPTE meeting that you and I both attended, which was really so about restoration.
I was just going to say that. It was so cool to see first the 70 millimeter projection of film clips from Oklahoma and The King and I, and then – this time I think I do have it right. 20th Century Fox did a DCI restoration of those.
That's a digital cinema transfer from film to digital.
Yes, and that's what this is. And you can tell even in a snapshot what the color saturation and contrast and quality is. And these are 2.55:1 clips that they supplied for this SMPTE meeting in Hollywood. And I just got a thrill. You know, seeing again, Quentin Tarantino gave us an opportunity to see Ultra Panavision using modern technology, classic lenses that they restored and tested for their quality, shot the way they would have shot them in the 60s, but today with his diabolical content and storyline, I will say. but it was a phenomenal looking presentation.
I did not see Hateful Eight because it was too violent, really, for me. I have a hard time in movies that are very violent and gory and bloody, and this apparently was a lot of that. So I never did see it. I almost did, but just to go see 70 millimeter, but I ended up not.
I had to see it because of the format, and I know his violence is coming, and it's always cartoon like. There's something else going on artistic. I mean, who can't see Pulp Fiction? And there's more violence in that, if you ask me, and it's more real than was.
Well, I didn't see that either for that same reason.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a classic. You're in the minority on that movie, I would say.
I know. I realize this.
Django Unchained. You missed that too, I'm sure.
I did. I did miss Django Unchained.
That ended with a flare. Okay, let's move down that document and see. I think we're going to be moving to. So this
Dolby
is
the Vision. I want to ask you about Dolby Vision. Yeah, absolutely.
A couple of these shots I took, if you go back up, you'll see a green screen. Why do I take a picture of the green screen saying, you know, this presentation is such and such? Because that tells me what the flat field uniformity on the screen is. So you can tell this is taken from the side. You can tell this is a native scope screen showing this, Captain America thing at the end of Spider-Man with all that white screen. And you don't see the hot spotting. The things that you do see are more because of my angle and camera than are actually on the screen. And that's because that's a white screen using Dolby 3D color filtering processes, so they don't need a silver screen with gain.
Well, Dolby Cinemas rarely – I've only seen one example where they actually show anything in 3D. They don't need – you're right. They don't need a polarization-preserving screen like IMAX 3D or Real-D 3D because, for one thing, they're not showing 3D. But two, if they were, they did in one case, Star Wars, I think, then you use a different kind of glasses and they're using a different technique that doesn't require a silver screen. So you have this white screen, and that shot of Captain America at the very end of Spider-Man was great because you, as you say, it's a perfectly white background and you can see the uniformity. It's difficult to see in this snapshot. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. And in fact, I'm amazed you were actually able to get any snapshots in these movie theaters. But you do get a good chance to judge uniformity in that particular shot, and there are some other ones as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So, well, there was almost nobody left in the theater. They didn't wait after the credits started rolling. They didn't know more stuff was coming. And if you're talking about how do I have the gall to take these shots, I'm very discreet and I sit in a place where I'm not disturbing anybody. I always do that because you know, I've got my phone shots. I'm not pulling a camera out. So, so the phone display, I've got it completely darkened. I can take the shot. Nobody really knows that I'm doing that. And I can grab them for the educational purposes to which I intend to use them.
Right. Exactly right. Exactly right.
So,
Mike Heiss is asking a question here. Speaking of Dolby Cinema, have you been to the TV Academy Theater? That's the Wolf at the Sabin Center in North Hollywood. Have you ever been to that theater? That's a private theater at the TV Academy. It's a Dolby Cinema, but it's not a commercial cinema. It's not open to the public.
No, I have not. Tell me about it.
It's a beautiful theater, larger than most. Doesn't have reclining seats, as I recall. Mike can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But the image and the sound are both fantastic, which leads me to my last question, because we are out of time here. Going back to Dunkirk, you saw it in several different formats. I saw it in two. I saw it in IMAX 70 millimeter and in Dolby Cinema with Dolby Vision. You saw it in standard or conventional 70 millimeter. You saw it in DCI, I think, which is sort of conventional digital. Did you see it in Dolby Cinema?
No, not Dunkirk.
Okay.
No, that was the Spider-Man showing I saw. So right, I don't know how they handled it. I will tell you this. I went when, was it Beauty and the Beast? What was released in March, where the Burbank Theater that I know you know well, that's the Dolby Vision and IMAX. They're right in the same Cineplex there, right next to each other.
Correct.
And in the IMAX theater, they were showing it in 1.85 in that theater. And in the Dolby Theater, they were showing it in scope. So the Dolby theaters seem to be emphasizing the scope format. The screen heights are about the same. The Dolby Vision Theater might be a little bit smaller than the height of the IMAX. I'm not sure. But they're presenting it in scope, and I like that. Screen should be the right height, and the width should be defined by the aspect ratio of the content.
Basically, what you're saying here to conclude, in terms of aspect ratio and changing aspect ratios, what you would recommend in a home cinema is what we call constant image height. That is, the height of the image stays the same, and the width of the image changes depending on the aspect ratio. Am I correct?
Correct. Yes. And all the original movie houses did it that way, especially when they were one or two screen houses. When Cineplex came to pass, they just didn't have they ran out of wall width often.
Yeah.
And if they used a scope screen and I went into the Metro Theater in Santa Barbara. It's a beautiful theater. It's probably the best theater in Santa Barbara. The Arlington is larger. I think 2,000 seats in the Arlington. The Metro is only 350 seats, and it's a scope format white screen, and the screen is only about 40 feet wide in that space. So, so it does what it does, but the presentation is very good in that theater. A screen is white. They do everything right in the large room. I mean, it's a multi-room. I think they've got four rooms or five.
It's a multiplex. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But it's not a Googleplex.
No. Yeah. And it's an old school. It was built. Oh, that has to be a 50 years theater.
Well, listen, we've run out of time and there's so much more we can talk about. Would you come back sometime and continue our discussion?
Yeah, we could discuss maybe the other five documents that I had queued up.
that we haven't showed yet.
We skirted on a lot of topics, so I very much enjoyed it.
Great, wonderful. Well, I'll look forward to having you back because there is something that we didn't get to today, but I definitely want to, which is sort of evaluating the performance of movie theaters and under various conditions and with various parameters. So we'll look forward to doing that again with you another time. Okay.
Indeed. Yes.
Great. Thank you so much.
My finale is my lighting comes up at D65 tuned.
Oh yeah. Okay, I love so that.
The whole
lighting in your theater is D65.
At D65. It's lighting up my Stewart sample panel over there. So you can kind of see it if I turn and get out of the way. That's my Stewart sample panel.
With all the different screen materials.
This is my native white screen. And what's cool about it, it's kind of fun. And the other thing we can talk about is audio, because at the top I've got my the immersive audio system that's coming to pass. And I'm using 16 channel as like where we like to start. So I can have six elevation channels, which I'm able to do through the Acuras or the Trinoff processors that I represent. And that gives you better uniformity, which we talked about sonically. You want a uniform hemisphere in your design, and I think that requires six elevation speakers to do it well. Otherwise, you've got spots.
We've got so much more to talk about. I'll look forward very much to having you come back.
Very good. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, John. That's John Bishop. He doesn't have a website at this moment, but you can email him if you have any questions. He's graciously allowed me to share his email. That's jbishop@b-accurate.com. So if you have any questions for John, please do shoot him an email on that address. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, John and I will continue our conversation about cinema, including how he evaluates the image and sound quality of what he sees. So I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.